Chapter 2, How I Became a Comedian. I wrote my first show in second grade. One afternoon, the girls in Mrs. Morrison's class surprised the boys by presenting a little review for us that we all considered very corny. It included, "I swear, I'm a little teapot." So I got the boys together, and we wrote a scathing parody of the girls' show. A few days later, we told Mrs. Morrison and the girls that we had a surprise for them in the AV room. During the show, some of the girls cried. Mrs. Morrison was a wonderful teacher, so she turned that sow's ear into a silk purse. Why not have Alan write a show that the boys and the girls can do together for your parents? I have just a vague memory of just one sketch for that show. It was a Civil War sketch where the joke was anachronisms. While the nurses were attending to wounded soldiers, they all heard the news of Lincoln's assassination on the radio. Not funny? I was 7! As much as Mom and Dad wanted me and Owen to go to college and win the Cold War, the fact that I chose to become a comedian had everything to do with them. My mother was my first audience. She was a stay-at-home mom until I went to kindergarten, so when I was little, we'd spend the day together, and I'd love to make her laugh. Now, this is a little embarrassing, but here it is. When I was 3 years old, Mom would have me do an impression of Jackie Gleason's signature, "And away we go," for company. My guess is there may be something not entirely healthy there, but I'll save that for my next book, The Sorrow and the Gavel, The Sad Inner Lives of U.S. Senators. Dad loved comedy, and I loved watching it with him and Owen and Mom in the TV room. His absolute favorite was Buddy Hackett. Now, Dad inhaled a pipe all his adult life. When I was a kid, if Dad got on a laughing jag, he'd start coughing at some point and inevitably end up coughing up phlegm into the clean, neatly pressed white handkerchief he always carried in his right front pocket. So if Johnny Carson said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Buddy Hackett," Mom would get up and leave the room. But the phlegm didn't bother me and Owen. Throughout grade school and junior high, I continued to be a good student and something of a comedian. I wasn't the class clown so much as I like to think a sly, observational comic. If I found a teacher like Mr. Knutson in sixth grade who dug my stuff, I'd play to the teacher. If I didn't like the teacher, like my eighth grade civics teacher, also named Mr. Knutson, I'd work the room at his expense. I think he sent me to stand in the hall about a dozen times during the school year. After ninth grade, Mom and Dad threw me a curve. Owen was now at MIT and was, therefore, the Franken family expert on college. He told my parents that the students at MIT were all nerds and wonks and that I should go to Harvard. Owen also said I should switch out of the St. Louis Park public school system, go to Blake, a country day private school in an adjacent suburb, because the wonks and nerds at MIT who had gone to private school were better prepared. I didn't hear about this conversation until years later. All I knew at the time was what Dad told me, which was, "You're going to take a test to go to a school for smart kids." Ever obedient, I said, okay. A few days later, Dad drove me to the beautiful Blake campus where I took the test. A couple weeks later, Dad told me, "You passed the test to get into the school for the smart kids." I spent the next 3 years at Blake. All in all, I had a pretty good experience, even if I was permanently scarred by going to an all-boys school. But again, I'll save that for a heart-wrenching chapter in The Sorrow and the Gavel, Escape from the Cloakroom. It turned out there were a lot of really smart kids at Blake, and some not so smart, kind of like St. Louis Park High School, where you didn't have to pay a lot of money and could interact on a daily basis with members of the opposite sex during a crucial developmental period of your life. Still, I found my way. Now, you may be asking, "I thought your dad had a modest income. How are you going to a hoity-toity prep school?" Well, good question, dear listener. Here's the deal. My grandmother, Clara Franken, Otto's widow, continued to live in her apartment near the Polo Grounds in Upper Manhattan and was an astonishingly frugal housefrau. Now, every Sunday morning at 9, Grandma would call us in Minnesota and Dad would answer, "Guten Morgen, Liebchen." The call would end abruptly when the operator informed them that 3 minutes were up. When we visited Grandma, she always wore the same old lady dress and baked us the best apple pie. She also saved everything, including, for some reason, shoe boxes full of worthless canceled postage stamps. She invested wisely in the stock market and left my parents enough money for Owen's and my education. Blake had all the elements of a British boarding school in a novel or movie, except we were just a bunch of goofy Midwestern kids who went home at night. But the stuffy vestiges of an outdated model for schooling boys gave a number of us something to rebel against, or at the very least, to make fun of. Tom Davis was a year behind me at Blake. I didn't meet him until he did an announcement with a group of other boys one morning in chapel. I don't remember what it was for, probably a meeting of the Glee Club or something. You know, I am kicking myself for not taking notes during my childhood. Anyway, all I remember is thinking, that guy's really funny. I made it a point to go up to Tom and introduce myself, and the comedy team of Franken and Davis was born. Chapel became our stage. We did announcements for practically every organization in the school, borrowing moves from comics that we both loved. Johnny Carson, Soupy Sales, Jack Benny, Peter Sellers, Woody Allen, the Smothers Brothers, George Carlin, Godfrey Cambridge, Bob Newhart, Richard Pryor, and Laurel and Hardy. We traded off being the straight man and the funny guy. We did a lot of physical comedy and threw in not-so-veiled barbs aimed at the school, but mainly we just did goofy stuff, like parodies of the hit movie Cool Hand Luke. "Anybody who doesn't go to the homecoming spends a night in the box." We'd write in each other's basements. Well, in my house, it was a basement. In Tom's house, it was a finished family room. At the time, Tom's dad, Don Davis, was a handsome middle-level executive at 3M. Tom's beautiful, sweet mom, Jean Davis, the former Jean Johnson, had been the 1950 Queen of the Lakes. Besides Tom, Don and Jean Davis had another son, Bob, who was 3 years younger. So that was Don, Jean, Tom, and Bob. Jean loved hearing me and Tom laughing from down in their finished basement. "Oh, you boys are so funny," she'd say, and bring us down some treats. But as the middle 60s turned into the late 60s, things started getting a little tense around the Davis household. Don, as Tom himself described him in his memoir, 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss, was a lifelong knee-jerk Republican and the uptight son of an alcoholic. In fact, Don's father, Tom's grandfather, drank himself to death. As Tom grew his hair and discovered pot and rock and roll and girls, all the ingredients were there for the classic Oedipal battle common to so many suburban baby boomers. Don didn't like Franken and Davis one bit, so Tom started spending more and more time at my house. Once Tom returned to his home after a couple days with the Frankens to find a newspaper clipping taped to his bedroom wall. The headline, "Student takes LSD, cuts off own penis." Things were getting a little tense at school as well. Our chapel material got edgier to the point where we were ruffling some feathers. So we turned our attention to pep fests that were parodies of pep fests, hanging the other team in effigy and repeatedly clubbing the dummy in the crotch with a baseball bat. The football coach, Mr. Mazenga, seemed to like it, though I'm not sure he was taking it at the same ironic level that the team and the rest of the students were. Meanwhile, Tom and I discovered a comedy review theater in Minneapolis called Dudley Riggs' Brave New Workshop. We actually saw adults on stage doing pretty much what we wanted to do, make audiences laugh. We started hanging out at the workshop, getting to know the performers and the impresario, Dudley Riggs, a former vaudevillian and circus performer. Dudley took a liking to us and suggested we come to an open stage night and do 10 minutes, so we did. We let off with a local newscast on the night of the day of World War III. I was the anchor. Tragedy, death, catastrophe. Highlight tonight's news at 10. I'm Ray Thompson, substituting for the deceased Chet Newholm. And now with the weather, meteorologist Bob Carlson. Bob? No, this is Tom. Well, don't grab those umbrellas just yet. Temperatures up to 6,000 degrees tonight. Winds gusting up to 500 miles per hour with occasional firestorms. Back to you, Ray. The stock market closed today for good. We got solid laughs, and Dudley told us he, quote, saw sparks. By the summer, we were doing one show a week at the workshop. Also, we got paid a little. Tom and I were professional comedians. At the end of that summer, I went off to college, still intent, I thought, on pursuing a career in science. In the back of my mind, show business didn't seem like a secure career choice for someone from Minnesota, though Bob Dylan had been kind of tearing it up in the 60s there. And unlike Bob Dylan, the poor loser, I had gotten into Harvard. I guess Dylan didn't test well. Unfortunately, by the end of the first semester of college, I could tell I wasn't cut out to be a scientist. Even though we had just beaten them to the moon, the Soviets were still something of a problem, but I knew my heart wasn't in it. Franny encouraged me to go to the counseling office, where I was given an extensive personality test, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, to see what career I was psychologically suited for. How do I remember which test I took? Because it consisted of 500 statements to which you answered yes or no, and I remember exactly one. I have never had any black tarry bowel movements. When I recently entered black tarry bowel movements into Google, the first item that popped up was an article about the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. In addition to questioning the validity of the test, the article said that this was the one question that everyone who takes the test remembers. And sorry, I can't tell you how I answered because I don't remember. I certainly haven't had any recently. The results were very interesting. The number one career match for Al Franken was jazz musician. Number two was camp counselor. Coming in dead last, scientist. Since I didn't play a musical instrument and had never been to an overnight summer camp, I decided that the 1-2 combo pointed to either jazz camp counselor, which sounded like an unimaginable bummer, or comedian, a career which was not on the Minnesota multiphasic list, but which I had been preparing for pretty much all my life. Years later, Dana Carvey said to me, "There's no reason to be a comedian unless you absolutely have to be." He didn't mean that comedians weren't able to do any other job. It's just that to be a comedian, comedy has to be the thing you absolutely have to do. Like a jazz musician has to be a jazz musician. And maybe some camp counselors just have to be camp counselors. It wasn't until that stupid Minnesota multiphasic that I felt like I had permission to pursue the career I actually had to pursue. Now, this was the early 70s, and there was this war in Southeast Asia. I got a 2S student deferment, which kept me out of the draft until graduation. In its wisdom, the government felt it was important for me to continue my studies so I could pursue my chosen profession, comedian, to keep America strong. I ended up majoring in behavioral sciences, sociology, anthropology, and psychology, which has actually been helpful in the Senate and might have been useful in Vietnam. Summers, I worked with Tom at Dudley's by night and by day for the St. Louis Park Street Department, where I worked on a crew with two other college guys. Our job was to mow weeds around water towers and other public buildings with industrial-sized mowers. Though Tom was an avid reader, he was at best an indifferent student, and after 2 years at the University of the Pacific, including a sophomore year during which he traveled through India and Nepal to study smoking hashish, Tom dropped out and became a cast member at Dudley's and a wonderfully inventive and hilarious improvisational comedian. Still, we do our two-man shows during the summer. One night, I got a horrible migraine after working all day in the sun. We went on with the show, but I had to bolt backstage to throw up, leaving Tom to improvise for a minute or two. The audience figured out what was going on because I just looked horrible, and at the end of the show, they gave us a standing ovation. Dudley watched the show from the back of the house and came backstage after the show to commend us. I was lying face down on a couch, but Tom asked him, what would have happened if Al had thrown up on stage? Oh, they would have all walked out, he said, with the total assurance of a showbiz veteran who had seen everything. Between my junior and senior years, Tom and I hitchhiked from Minneapolis to L.A., kids don't do this, to perform at the Comedy Store. Our 20 minutes killed, and suddenly we were on the radar of our contemporaries, struggling comedians trying to get a break. During my senior year, Tom came out to Cambridge and stayed in my dorm room. He smoked pot, played frisbee, and didn't go to classes, and thus was often mistaken for a student. On weekends, Tom and I would drive two or three marginally more prosperous students down to Manhattan in exchange for gas money and perform at the Improvisation with comedians like Jay Leno, Robert Klein, and Andy Kaufman. In 1973, Franny and I graduated, and the three of us drove out to Hollywood. Tom and I played the Comedy Store, where Franny worked as a cocktail waitress, and a few other clubs around L.A. Occasionally, we'd go on the road and play colleges in the Midwest for $500 a gig. One spring, we did a show at Huron State College in South Dakota. As we drove up to the student union, we noticed there were no cars. They had booked us during spring break. There are a grand total of 7 students remaining on campus who couldn't make it home for the break. 6 were African-American guys from the East Coast. Tom asked them why there were 6 of them, and one said, Riley, in case one of us fouls out. The other kid was a very depressed junior who had been caught smoking pot during his sophomore year and as punishment was confined to campus for the remainder of his college career except for summers. Tom and I did our show for the 7 bummed out students and a custodian. They were actually a pretty good audience. We were doing a lot of political material back in those days, including lots and lots of Nixon stuff. I'd play Nixon to Tom's David Eisenhower, and then Tom would play Nixon to my Henry Kissinger. For younger listeners, David Eisenhower was President Eisenhower's grandson and Nixon's son-in-law, married to Nixon's daughter, Julie. We ate a lot of rice and beans and did odd jobs. During Christmas season, we'd alternate between playing Santa and Winnie the Pooh at Sears in North Hollywood. Sears had declined to let us play Nixon. When you're starting out in comedy, you meet a lot of other people doing the same thing, and you influence each other. A comedy writer friend of ours, Matt Newman, grew up in New York and had collected hours of Bob and Ray on reel-to-reel audio tape. Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding were a radio comedy team in New York from the 50s through the 80s who developed a cult following of generations of fans from Groucho Marx to Johnny Carson to David Letterman. Tom and I had seen Bob and Ray a few times on The Tonight Show and were fans ourselves. Listening to hours of these Bob and Ray tapes, Tom and I heard both what we had been trying to do and what we wanted to become. Like them, neither of us were exclusively the straight man or the funny man. They were dry and gently subversive, committed to their characters, various gas bags, self-serving idiots, and absurdly banal authorities. Tom and I would sit with Matt, smoking dope and laughing our asses off at Bob's mild-mannered reporter, Wally Blue, who promoted himself as radio's highly regarded Wally Blue, winner of 11 Diction Awards, 2 of which are cufflinks. On shows like Widen Your Horizons, with sponsors like Einbinder Flypaper, the name you've gradually grown to trust over 3 generations, Bob would interview Ray, an expert on how to floss, who would point out that to floss properly, you don't actually have to have one hand inside your mouth. When I first got to the Senate, I discovered that Kansas Senator Pat Roberts, a very funny arch-conservative, but one that you can work with, and 15 years my senior, is a huge Bob and Ray fan. One day early on, I brought over a CD I'd made from some of Matt's tapes to Pat's office, and we laughed and laughed. I never asked Pat if he had ever listened to them while smoking dope. Frankly, it's none of my damn business. Franny and I had smoked pot in college, but Tom introduced us to LSD and the Grateful Dead, I think in the reverse order. We'd drive around California in our Volkswagen bus following the Dead, so we are in danger of being a cliche. Years later, though, I'd bond with Vermont Senator Pat Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, over our love of the Dead. I didn't even have to ask Leahy whether he had ever dropped acid. After all, he started his career as a prosecutor. So Tom and I were Deadheads and Bob and Ray heads. We were beginning to get noticed, and I'll always remember the moment I knew that we had made it. It was December 1974, and we were offered a chance to be part of a show at Harrah's Casino in Reno called The Boob Tube Review. No, that wasn't the moment. The Boob Tube Review was pretty awful. What? You could tell from the name that it was awful? Still, the awful show was popular, and Frank and Davis were something of a hit in Reno. One night, management decided to throw a party to honor the cast of the Boob Tube Review, and that's where I saw it. An enormous platter holding a gigantic mound of jumbo shrimp. Now, let me explain. For my dad, the worst part of moving to Minnesota in 1955 was that he loved seafood, especially clams, softshell crabs, lobster, and shrimp. In the 50s and 60s, you simply could not get fresh seafood in Minnesota. Every summer, we'd all drive to New York to visit my Uncle Irwin and his family, and the biggest treat for me was the seafood. I remember thinking, I'll know I'll have made it when I can eat as much shrimp as I want. That evening in Reno, I probably ate 3 dozen jumbo shrimp. So far as I was concerned, I'd made it well before Tom and I got hired for Saturday Night Live.